Let's have a nice cup of TRE in the afternoon with Hannah Murray.
Good afternoon. Joining us on the line now is William Hazelgrove. He's a best-selling author of 10 novels and 13 non-fiction books. His latest book is Dead Air, The Night That Orson Welles Terrified America, taking us back to Halloween Eve in 1938, when he put on that radio play of War of the Worlds, terrorizing an uneasy American public on the brink of World War II, perpetuating the greatest hoax in history and changing media forever. Welcome to the show. Hello, William.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for being with us. So why did you decide to go back in time and write a book on this?
Yeah, I've always been fascinated with Orson Welles. And a book came out about 5-7 years ago saying that this really wasn't a big deal, that a lot of people didn't believe it. It was mostly confined to the East Coast. So I dove in and went back to all the newspapers of that time. And I found out that this was massive panic with suicides, heart attacks, accidents, people running for the hills, just total pandemonium, really, from coast to coast. And again, Orson Welles is, you know, such a fascinating character. At 23, he puts on this amazing radio show, War of the Worlds. And then, of course, gets catapulted into Hollywood to make Citizen Kane. So that's really when he's at his zenith.
That's unbelievable. I mean, one thing to cause mass panic, but to cause deaths and suicides, I mean, that's huge. How is it that so many people believed that what he was saying was true then? Explain that.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the Sudetenland crisis, where Hitler had threatened to invade Czechoslovakia, had just occurred. And, you know, everybody thought, oh, here comes World War II. And so what was going on? The golden age of radio. And what was going on there was breaking news bulletins. So people, you know, every few minutes would be a breaking news bulletin, and people were glued to their radios. Also, too, for the first time, people had radios in their cars. So people were on edge. They really believed war was going to break out any minute. Also, too, there was a terrific hurricane the week before War of the Worlds. And again, you know, breaking news bulletin. So Welles comes along and decides to do H.G. Welles' novel, War of the Worlds. And he takes a very novel approach. He decides to do it as a breaking news bulletin, you know, in that format. And, you know, a lot of people, revisionist history, have said, oh, he didn't really mean to do it. He absolutely meant to do it. This is pure Orson Welles. He's the kind of guy who would thump you on the back of the head and ask you if he saw stars when you look through his telescope. You know, he was a bit of a trickster, a bit of a magician. He also was a brilliant artist.
Yeah. So when he did it as a news bulletin, presumably he was just thinking, well, I don't know. You tell us what he was thinking. Was he thinking, you know, this is a bit of fun. This will be a trick. You know, I wonder whether people will think it was real. Did he have any idea the effect that it would have?
You know, I think he did, because what happened was during the broadcast, a CBS executive tried to break into the studio and they wouldn't let him in. The reason he was trying to break in is because the phones were just lighting up with people, you know, asking where the Martians are, where, you know, because the story is Martians land in Grover's Mill, New Jersey, and they start incinerating people with a heat ray gun and poisonous gas. So they don't let him in the studio. Welles is on the air. He sees this and he keeps going. And his station break is 20 minutes away. And Welles planned that as well. Then the police come in, because the police are getting deluged with calls as well. And again, they try and break into the studio. Welles' partner, John Houseman, his producer, doesn't let him in. And this shows that they knew, you know, they were going to really do something. Welles had also begun to tire radio. This was his 17th program, Mercury on the Air. He needed a bigger platform. He wanted to get to Hollywood. He thought of, he only had 1 million listeners. And so what happened was, during this one night, there was another show called Charlie McCarthy Hour. And basically, they had like 10 million listeners. Well, they went to a singer, you know, Annie Cantor, and all these people started dialing, started surfing the radio dial, as we do today. And they landed on Welles's program, which, by the way, is a broadcast and a broadcast. It begins with, you know, this orchestra in a hotel in New York. So people who were listening to this, there'd be a breaking news format. There'd be the breaking news bulletin. They would, you know, be sucked into it. So into the second broadcast, which is the breaking news. So again, people started moving along. Suddenly, Wells went from 1 million listeners to about 11 million listeners. So he really got supercharged on that night.
Gosh, incredible. It's just amazing to imagine, isn't it, how it would have affected people. You can just kind of picture people listening to their radios and then thinking, oh my goodness, that's it, these Martians are coming and we're all going to die. I mean, it is the kind of thing you'd see in a film.
Oh yeah. Well, one gentleman came home to find his wife facing a vial of poison. He said, what are you doing? And she said, I'd rather die this way then, you know, had the Martians kill me. And another gentleman, his daughter was in college about 100 miles away. He jumps in his car, goes to the college, takes off the doors of his car because all these girls are there crying. He loads his car up with all these girls, straps some of them to the hood and the trunk, and then drives 70 miles an hour, you know, home with all these crying girls because they all thought this was the end of the world. People were running into theaters, screaming it's the end of the world. Their churches were just deluged with people screaming it's the end of the world. People were running out of restaurants, not paying their checks, you know, out of bars. People were literally driving for the hills. And the police couldn't understand why everybody was speeding. You know, everybody was speeding, but it was just because, again, they had just passed the AM Amplitude Act, which said you have to have a car radio. And so this was a very new phenomenon. One gentleman on the West Coast, a Hollywood executive, was in the Redwood Forest. He hears the broadcast. They try and get home. They run out of gas in the woods. And he later writes that he and his wife just had to sit there and wait for the Martians to exterminate them.
Gosh. So when people, you know, hear all this and they look back on the event, do you think Orson Welles is seen more of a creative genius or as an irresponsible idiot?
You know, that's a great question. You know, after the broadcast, all these people wanted to sue him. And you know, he felt he was done in Hollywood, or rather in New York and radio. And so he left, went back home for a while to Illinois. And, you know, people wanted his head. But then a woman named Dorothy Parker wrote a column where she was a very famous columnist. And she basically said, Welles did everybody a favor. It shows how ignorant and uneducated the American public is and how they'll swallow anything. You know, we live at a time now where fake news is in the news and all this stuff. But really what Welles said later, he admitted that he did this on purpose. He said later, the reason he did it was he wanted to show people not to believe everything that comes to the radio is true. Because, you know, again, radio was a very new phenomenon. And Welles was there during the golden age where a lot of experimentation was going on. People were listening to series or series like Amos and Andy that was so popular. Theaters would stop the movie, roll in a big radio and let people listen to it and then start the movie again. So this was, you know, sort of like streaming when streaming came in about 10 years ago and people are like, oh my God, I can watch all these episodes. This had happened with the radio. So Welles was right at the pinnacle of that. And in 23, he pulls off this incredible hoax that propels him into Hollywood. So back to your question. Trickster, brilliant. I think it's whatever, you know, side of the coin you sit on. I will say this, Welles did have a brilliance that lent itself very well to radio, probably better than the movies.
Yeah. And also when people kind of think about how things have changed and how news has changed and how we view radio and all that kind of thing, can you imagine anything remotely like that happening today, or has anything remotely like this happened since, do you think?
Well, you know, they did. They tried to duplicate this. Several radio stations did after this because it was great, actually, for CBS. Welles got a sponsor through Campbell's Soup and all this. And it's, you know, publicity sells. But people just didn't buy off on it the way they did at this moment. It was really sort of a perfect storm. It happened at a time when America was on edge. Radio was new. People, you know, had just been just sort of bombarded with these breaking news bulletins. And here it comes again. And so at this moment in time, on the eve of World War II, you know, everyone was sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop. And the other shoe was the War of the Worlds. Could it happen again today? I think we see variations of it all the time. You know, we're quite, you know, in media where people are constantly, you know, putting stuff out that may not be true, and people have to question. But we are much more sophisticated listeners today than people were in 1938, where literally radio was just this new phenomenon that enjoyed incredible growth right before Wells went on. So everybody had a set.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? The whole concept of news and the crossover between news and entertainment, which I think we've seen a lot more in recent years. You know, on the television, particularly how news reporters have to be at every single place, even if there's nothing happening behind them. That, you know, that they're there on the scene, on the ground, kind of thing, and making it all the more dramatic.
That's right. And, you know, Hannah, at the time, there was a news show, it was the most popular show on the radio called March of Time, where it was produced news. In other words, they didn't want the real event. They would recreate it with sound effects. In fact, when the Hindenburg crashed, WLS had a man on the site there in Chicago. It's a radio station. They made a recording of it. They were going to put it on the air. And then studio executive said, no, we want this to be recreated. We don't believe live news is what people want to hear. So it was really the opposite. Now, what was the effect of Wells' broadcast? That all ended. The FCC came out and said, no more produced news, no more recreated news. News has to be real now. So we went really, it changed then. But as you said, now we're sort of drifting back where news is, you know, getting a little show busy and you know, a little bit more celebrity driven and you know, more entertainment than hard news.
Yeah. And it's also very selective as well. It's down to the, well, that begs the question, it's down to the program controller, or it's down to the people who control the whole network, or however far it goes back, as to what they want the news to be. You know, everybody, well, not everybody, but some people will be well aware that there's many other conflicts and disasters and things that are happening in the world that never make the news, where hundreds of thousands of people die, but they're not on the news. So most people, unless they're looking in alternative places, don't know about certain things that are going on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, all you have to do is say, look at a newspaper like the New York Times, and you'll see how it's changed, how there's, you know, news about some celebrity who, you know, bought a mansion or something on the front page. And, you know, that was not the case before. I mean, hard news, which we probably have to go back to pre-internet, you know, was really more factually driven. Now, going all the way back to William Randolph Hearst, who ran these big newspapers since the turn of the century, he, you know, created yellow journalism, where news was sensationalized at that time. And in fact, in full circle, Wells and Citizen Kane lampooned William Randolph Hearst, and Hearst took his revenge on Wells and, you know, hurt his movie. Citizen Kane lost $150,000 at the box office, and Wells had a hard time ever getting funding for the rest of his life for news. So in that case, Wells went too far. In War of the Worlds, Wells walked up to the cliff, almost fell over, but then he came out like a rose, got these Hollywood contracts and everything. But he did the same thing in Hollywood, and it really blew up in his hand. So, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same, really.
Yeah, it's a fantastic story. And we thank you very much for sharing it with us. If people want to get a copy of the book, it's called Dead Air, The Night That Orson Welles Terrified America. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by William Hazelgrove, who we've been chatting with today. William, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.